Sisters, lovers, everybody, today we are going to talk about embracing identity politics and how to loudly be yourself. We are going to touch on the historical background of the term and how our identities are highly political, whether you want it or not. And at the end of the day, who's really afraid of identity politics?
Hi, lovers, to the newest episode of Vocal About It. We are happy to be back in 2020.
Whoop, whoop.
And we have another change to announce in our structure. And we want to invite you in our process. Because Sarah and I, we've both been coming to the conclusion that we don't feel very comfortable with women only anymore, because we feel that this is reductive and this is not what we are about. And also, as all these binaries, nature, science, civilized, wild, man, woman, are all rooted in colonialism, we want to abandon this thinking, and as of now, we are also celebrating the non-binary. In this sense, I would like to celebrate an amazing author, the Nigerian non-binary trans author Ekweke Emezi, who is highly acclaimed for their first novel, Freshwater, where they are writing about the multitude of personality elements inside of them. They are also very open about mental health and speak honestly about how they had a lot of breakdowns during their writing process, which I find very interesting. And also it makes space for all of us to discuss these kind of topics when we are writing. I haven't dived into that one yet, but I'm currently reading their new book, which is a young adult novel with the title Pet, and is dealing with a world where adults deny that monsters still exist because they can see them. It's a very intriguing lesson on how the evil doesn't always look like what you expect it to look like, and how dangerous it is when you forget how monsters can make themselves appear neutral and therefore get invisible.
Dope! So today, I don't have one specific sister I'd like to celebrate or to talk about. I am raging for a few days already because of an event that happened, which is just another one. Nothing special for a black woman in this world. But I'm basically raging against police brutality against black bodies. So Claudia Simange is a 42-year-old mom that was beaten up violently by the police in front of her 8-year-old daughter. I'm not even getting to the why, because no matter why, this should never happen. But basically, there's a lot of very traumatic photo of her after the beat up, which is quite horrible. And there is many layers, if not all the layers, of Portuguese society being extremely racist. And we're now only having these conversations, which is honestly just preventing me from sleeping properly at night. But I just want to celebrate her and all the black women in Portugal who have denounced these acts for years already and always find the strength to do so. Because I sometimes don't even have the strength to click on an article when the photo I see is of a black woman having a completely destroyed face by a beat up by the authority who's supposed to protect us. So I want to celebrate and send tons of power and love and appreciation to Francisca Van Dumen, who's the Minister of Justice, who's been vocal about racism in Portugal for years already. I want to celebrate Beatriz Gomes Dias, who's an activist from Jazz and a politician now. I want to celebrate Carla Fernandez from Afrolish, Ana Fernandez da Plataforma Negra, who've been fighting against this for a really, really long time. Clearly, their voice have not been heard so much. And I just want to celebrate all the black women in this world who survive and have to deal with the trauma.
I would like to start this episode with a quote of Grada Quilomba, who is a Portuguese author, psychologist, post-colonial theorist, and professor at the Humboldt University in Berlin, with roots in Angola. And in her lecture performance, Decolonizing Knowledge, she is constructing the classic production of knowledge and is dismantling how violence is inscribed in these practices. Here comes. When they speak, it's scientific. When we speak, it's unscientific. When they speak, it's universal. When we speak, it's specific. When they speak, it's objective. When we speak, it's subjective. When they speak, it's neutral. When we speak, it's personal. When they speak, it's rational. When we speak, it's emotional. When they speak, it's impartial. When we speak, it's partial. They have facts. We have opinions. They have knowledges. We have experiences. We're not dealing here with a peaceful coexistence of worlds, but rather with a violent hierarchy which defines who can speak and what we can speak about. And with this powerful quote, we start into the newest episode.
All right, so diving into a new episode, I just want to, you know, wish all of the lovers listening a happy, healthy, energized, sexy 2020, because we haven't talked in the new year. What's up? What's good, lovers? Are you ready for a new year of Sarah and Sarah? You better. All right, so we're just gonna, yeah, dive into the topic of identity politics. And just to make sure we're all on the same line, I just want to, you know, throw in a little definition and explain a little bit where the term is even coming from. So, like a good person who's serious about research, I went on to the good old Urban Dictionary for the definition. And it says that it's basically identity politics is utilizing pride in identities to create a sense of uniqueness, belonging, recognition, and raise awareness. Often, each group prioritizes the concerns of the group over the whole in an effort to give equal liberties to minorities. Identity politics offset the gap in a democracy where every man is created equal, but the majority rules. Obviously, not the greatest definition, but that gives you an idea. And just for you all to understand, the term identity politics was actually first coined by a Black feminist called Barbara Smith. Black woman again. And the Combahee River Collective, which is a Black feminist lesbian organization that was active in Boston and around from 1974 to 1980. And so identity politics originated from the need to reshape movements that had until then prioritized the monotony of sameness over the strategic value of difference. Voila, so this is where it originated. So it's not something new. We're not trying to create some new wave of something else. Basically, same old shit. You know how it is. Racism is just always making sure to just rule. And yeah, we're just going to talk about how our lives are political, whether we want it or not. We're going to talk about who's actually afraid of identity politics. And feel free to interact and send us your reactions while you're listening to it on social media, because why not?
Yes, awesome. Yeah, maybe let's start with who's afraid of identity politics and how this starts. I think it's a very, a process that starts early on for many people of color, and specifically women of color, because how oppression works. So when I started, I have to say something like my career in communication, I actually had several white older men coming towards me to make sure, and this is really interesting looking back, that I don't get lost in identity politics. So they came towards me, They came towards me and told me, look, this is what people of color always do. Like, once they discover, also very colonial, their identity, they just whoop, off they are, swoops, out of the window, out of the white world. And don't do that, because you really have potential, you have talent.
You're not like them.
Exactly. So you can be the trans later of worlds, you can be the bridge, and don't get lost, don't get caught up in it, and keep up the good work in our world. And that really that put a seed in my mind that was really, really hard to dig out again. And I actually observed myself thinking this way all the time, that in order for white people to understand me, in order to understand that for them that I'm not a threat, and that I actually only want to do educational work and just make them understand that I'm human too, I would always keep on doing that. And I think that was so interesting when we started our podcast, that we always had to get rid of this kind of thinking, that we would always try and bridge and always try and make it digestible, make it easily accessible for white people, when in reality, of course, number one, they could find out about it if they wanted to. They are learning about quantum mechanics on their own for fun. So they are already on the internet. They could easily do that. But number two, and this is more important, they don't want to. They want to keep you in this loop of explaining yourself over and over and over again, because then you're still navigating in their world and operating on their terms. And you don't get lost in what is your own power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it really takes a while for, you know, Black people and people of color to decolonize our mind in a ways to not fucking bridge and to not adjust all the time in our vocabulary, in our attitudes, in our body language. And that's why we code switch a lot, you know, in different spaces as well. But We'll get there. We'll get there. And on this about who's afraid of identity politics, I, you know, did a lot of research for the episode. And just by very simply typing identity politics on google.com, the funny thing is all the negative articles are, guess what? Surprise, surprise. Written by old white men. And I saw this one, which I'm not going to get in details about. It's a very small piece on the Wall Street Journal. And that titles, Dr. King would be sad about our identity politics. It's basically a few lines of white tears. And I love how people have the nerve to always use Dr. King, who's supposed to be the peaceful one after whitewashing, to use basically against us, which I think is very funny. Now, I also want to dive in the fact that actually, when we talk about identity politics, it also applies to a lot of white people. And when you talk about white nationalism, white terrorism as well, it is rooted in something that basically applies only to one specific group. And so I read this very insightful article in The Guardian, written by Kenan Malik, and that basically talks about how white nationalism also fit in, or does it, in identity politics. And so just to quote it real quick, one of the consequences of the bifurcated debate is historical amnesia about the origins of identity politics. Most people imagine that its roots are on the left. In fact, they lie on the reactionary right in the counter-enlightenment of the late 18th century. It wasn't then called the politics of identity, it was called racism. It is, however, the concept of race, the instance that humans are divided into a number of essential groups, and that's one group's identity determines one's moral and social place in the world, that we find the original politics of identity, out of which ideas of white supremacy emerged. The old politics of identity faded, but a new form emerged. Identity politics as a weapon yields not in the name of racism, but to confront oppression and to change inequality. And that's the thing. It's interesting that identity politics became scary to certain people when it was for other groups. What's up?
That's very interesting. And why? And why do they want to keep you from doing that? Because that basically means that they are losing their influence over you when you just step into that. And this is, I guess, why they are trying to persuade you that it's only for your own good when you don't stop speaking their language or build bridges or cover topics that are important to them. But in reality, you are keeping yourself caught up in a system that is based on their values and where their power is present and yours isn't. And I guess that why they are so afraid has very good reasons, because what happens when we take advocacy for ourselves, when we take this into our own hands? Because what if we realize that we don't need the white man to save us, our country, our women, our children? What if we realize we don't need approval by the white man to understand our value, our power, and our beauty? The white man then becomes obsolete. And then they are at the margins. And this they can't have. So don't forget that this is what they are about when people are afraid of identity politics.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I truly find that, you know, there's a lot of complexities also around identity politics. So we're not trying to say, you know, essentializing identity politics as in us women or us women of color or us black women, because even within this group, there's a lot of different layers and we are complex and multidimensional humans. But I read this very good piece on Galdem where the sister was basically saying that being exposed to identity politics really helped her to draw connections between personal experiences and systemic dynamics of power within society, which is exactly this. And I could relate so much. And I find that to be very powerful. And that's where I think it's important to embrace that, because it will also protect you. I think it will protect you from certain people trying to make you feel bad because, oh, but don't you want to talk about this as a black woman? Don't you have anything to say? When we're just out here trying to protect our energy. And so I remember actually last year in Brussels, there was a very last minute, well, what felt like a last minute gathering against racism after the European elections. Lol, because apparently everybody was surprised, you know, apart from us. So basically a lot of different people gathered in front of the European Parliament to express their outrage following the results of the European election and the uprising of basically racist parties across the European Union, which to me was okay. I mean, you know, again, there was a few different articles and a lot of talks that were basically saying to people, we've been telling y'all for years. Clearly you didn't want to listen or you didn't want to believe us, but that's the shit we've been living with. That's the shit we knew. So nobody here is surprised. And I remember some white people having dinner asking me, hey, are you coming to the protest? You know, we all got to show up. And I just thought to myself and then said, my life as a black woman is political already. Thank you very much. Meaning that me leaving my house every morning is a political act of resistance. Me having a fucking podcast called Vocal about it is an act of war, basically. So I'm good. Yeah, I'm not going to go out there and protest for things that I've been telling you all about for years already. And I think, you know, being so anchored in my identity politics really helped me to build that for myself and to have the power of also protecting my energy and not always go out there fighting fights that I'm actually fighting just by breathing every day.
Exactly. Exactly. You are the bridge already. This is your reality every damn day. And I actually think, you know, it's really actually kind of violent again that they would act on this and say like, you as a black woman, you aren't you angry? Don't you want to stand up? Like, this is our life every day. Mm-hmm. It's not like we can turn it off and on again when there is an opportunity for white people to shine or show their outrage or show compassion. This is for us every day. And I mean, I don't know, if they don't show up for us, if they don't listen to what we've been saying for decades and centuries even, how can you expect us to fight this fight with you? Like, clearly this isn't the same fight that we're fighting then.
Precisely. And I just want to quote Auntie Stacey Abraham, who was the very first black woman in the US history to win a major party gubernatorial nomination, and that just stands for like government stuff. And she basically says that identity politics will strengthen the democratic rule and not threaten it. And she was being interviewed about her win and how she wants to basically create her strategy. And she was basically saying that the notion of identity politics has been peddled for the past 10 years and has been used as a dog whistle to say we shouldn't pay too much attention to the voices coming into progress. And she then said, I would argue that identity politics is exactly who we are and exactly how we won. And I found that to be very powerful because I think we need not to be scared of that. We need to be anchored in who we are. And that's also where intersectionality comes in. Yeah. So we have the basis of gender and race and then so many different things that basically define who we are. And I think the more we embrace it, the more we can actually create very powerful action and yeah, just flip tables and create some change up in this bitch.
Yes, exactly. Also, I think it's really funny how everybody acts as if identity politics wasn't everywhere. Every type of politics is identity politics, but now it's just the more powerful who can act as if this is neutral and politics for everyone, when in reality it's just serving the interests of white, rich, straight, cishet. But everybody else, I mean, how is that working out for the world? Last time I checked, it was burning, so... I'm not sure if this is working out for anyone else. So maybe we should reconsider whose identity politics actually is harmful.
This is a very important point. I think that actually, you know, and we're talking from a place here in Brussels, having all the European institutions, but a group of cis hetero men over 50 years old in suits coming from the exact same social background discussing about the word in a very privileged space isn't identity politics. That's really funny to me. And if you put the exact same situation, and not even in an institution, so if you just have a gathering of black people and people of color in a fucking terrace of a cafe, everybody's going to be scared. And the looks you're going to get and the suspicion, and people are going to pass by and just look at you, you know, a bit more insistently than they would normally do. So basically, there is this low-key threat that we represent somehow. And I find that to be very interesting. And I actually do believe, and I will say this very peacefully, I do believe that white people live with the threat and with the fear of black people and people of color taking revenge. I actually really do think that's a thing. And that's why they're so scared of identity politics and making a big deal out of it. That's why they take the smallest events and make it a huge deal whenever a black person or person of color does think that to them is slightly threatening. And that's why they just get into this white fragility whenever they're confronted with their problematic behavior. Because they know that if in this world we actually gather for revolution, which we do, but don't tell anyone... If we would do that and actually take revenge for like fucking 23% of what they did to the global south, my friends, they would be fucked. And they know it. So I think everything lies into this background of colonialism and the perpetuation of dynamics that make sure to maintain this minority in the world. And let's remember, white people represent only, I think, around 18% of people in the world. And we are the global majority. Yeah, I just want to say that, just putting it out there. You do what you want with that information.
It's absolutely true, of course, because they know deep down, they know it's not right. It's not just, and the second something like this comes up, this becomes like conscious on a level, and then it makes them very uncomfortable. And then they have to lash out against it because they know that actually, once justice would be restored, things would look very differently. Mm-hmm. And obviously, they are afraid of that. And yeah, as you're saying, everybody can be glad that we are just up for equality.
Right. Enough about white people.
All right. I think that there is just one last thing that I would like to add. And then I really, shut up about it altogether. And it's the last time that I'm going to bring it up. I promise. I swear. Okay. So white people. No, for real though. For real. So they come up with this idea that their standard position in the world is just like universal neutral objective, as we have heard in the beginning. And then I thought about this, and then I thought that everybody who is like not this imagined majority, as we have just heard, they are not the majority, it's just depictured everywhere as if that was the center of the universe. But basically, so let's say the center of the world is white, cis, able-bodied, rich. Everybody else who is not of this imagined majority always sees two worlds. They always see the white world, but they always also see their world of color. They always see the straight world as it is depicted as the normal everywhere, and they always see the queer world. They see the able-bodied world, but they also see the disabled-bodied. They see the rich world, the wealthy world, but they also see what it's like to live a precarious life. So there's always these multitudes. It's as if white people are looking through this one-dimensional lens to the world and everybody else is looking through a kaleidoscope. So how on earth can everybody say that seeing less is universal when the gaze is actually, when it comes from everywhere else, one that is deeper into the world? So don't let anyone tell you that your gaze is less than a white gaze.
But that reminds me real quick of Mari Da Silva, who's this amazing coach in strategy on how to survive as a black woman or woman of color, specifically in France. And she always mentions that. She says that we, as racialized women, basically, we've always been sitting at the back of the room. But what people don't realize is that from the back of the room, you see everything. And I think of white people always taking first row because that's where they belong. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what you say. They see fucking one dimension. They see only part of it and they never turn back because what's there to see? Yeah. And on a more practical real life thing, I now make it a rule for myself. Whatever event I go to, conference, movie, whatever, I go on the first row.
Yes.
Just reclaiming my space.
And also talking, like just to like grab the mic and speak because... That is also, I think that's outrageous. Like we talked about this at the Sonia Sanchez reading, right? So there were so many people of color and black people in the room, and maybe three of them were white. And of course, they were all sitting in the first row. And of course, these three people felt entitled to say something after the reading of Sonia freaking Sanchez. Everybody was just like all inspired, but they were like, I gotta add something, which I find really outrageous. And I think it's really about reclaiming your space and understanding that you have not only a right to be there, but you are powerful and this space belongs to you. And don't let anyone shame you when you are speaking your own language, when you are reclaiming your own space, and when you are stepping into your own power. But this is what we're going to talk about the next episode.
Ooh, little teaser. Ooh, I like. Mm-hmm. Just to conclude, mm-hmm. I want to encourage our sisters and lovers listening to be loudly woman X, to loudly be black, to loudly be racialized, to loudly be queer. Make noise from the margins and loudly be yourselves. Also, make sure to protect each other and know that when you embrace yourself in your identity politics, you are anchored as fuck and nothing can shake you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Vocal About It. If you enjoy our real talk, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Make sure to share us on your platforms and follow us on Twitter and Instagram under the handle vocalabout_it. If you have a sweet feedback or want to cooperate, drop us an email under vocalaboutit@gmail.com.